From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Senator Strom Thurmond became famous as a passionate segregationist. After he died at the age of 100, just over 1 year ago, Essie Mae Washington Williams came forward to say that she was his secret daughter. Her mother was African American and had worked as a maid for the Thurmond family. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Essie Mae Washington Williams about her relationship with her father. She's written a new memoir. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us what a best-selling grammar book and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy have in common, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a DVD and CD featuring Maria Callas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina was one of the most passionate supporters of segregation in the 50s and 60s. In 1957, he set a record for the longest filibuster in history while opposing civil rights legislation. Shortly after he died at the age of 100 in 2003, Essie Mae Washington Williams publicly announced that she was the secret daughter of Thurmond and an African-American woman who had worked as a maid in his family's house. The story of Washington Williams' paternity was such a big secret that even she wasn't told about it until she was 16. But that wasn't the first shock about her family. At the age of 13, her aunt Carrie came to visit and revealed that she wasn't her aunt, she was her mother. The woman Washington Williams thought was her mother's sister. Washington Williams was raised by her aunt in Pennsylvania while her mother stayed in the South. In the new memoir, Dear Senator, Washington Williams tells the story of her life. She's in her late 70s now. I asked her if it was difficult to relearn the identities of her mother and her aunt.
Well, it wasn't that difficult, but it would have been helpful if my aunt had told me that my mother was coming, and I would have been expecting her. But when she came, it was a total surprise. And for her to say that she was my mother, and I said, no, I'd never met her. I didn't know her. And I said, my mother is in the other room. And she said, no, I'm your mother, and she's my sister. She explained it at that point. And had that been done earlier, it would have been clearer to me and not come as a surprise.
How old were you when your mother took you to meet your father?
16 years old.
Now, she hadn't told you anything about him.
Not prior to going south to see her sister who had passed. We all go into the funeral. And while she was there, she took off the next day after the funeral to see if she could locate my father. She did not tell me anything at that time. It wasn't until she actually found him that she came back and told me to get dressed. She wanted to take and introduce me to my father. It was walking distance. And on the way, she showed me the house where they had lived. She worked there as a young girl with her sister, with one of her younger sisters. And she started to tell me things about him and to give me a little information. However, the one thing that she hadn't mentioned was that he was Caucasian. I didn't know that he was Caucasian until I actually met him. She had never mentioned that. That was a total surprise.
You write that when a black servant opened the door, you assumed, oh, this was going to be your father.
Well, I didn't know, you see. I wasn't expected to be a person other than a black person, you know. But it was fine. I was happy to meet him, and the color really didn't make any difference.
At this point in Strom Thurmond's life, he was a lawyer. It was before he entered politics. You write in your book, out of nowhere, I had become Southern aristocracy. Was there any part of you that was angry or resentful that this wealthy white man had not acknowledged your existence or his paternity until you were...
Not until I met him. I didn't know how much, if anything, that he knew about me, but from the time we were introduced, he became a part of my life.
So you weren't angry that he'd been
out
of the
angry.
Picture for so long?
No, I wasn't angry. Yeah, you don't always know the circumstances, and of course, by that time, I knew that there were separations of the races in the South. Everything was separate, even the restrooms, the water fountains, all public places. So that was the custom in those days. And it wasn't anything to be happy about, but on the other hand, I wasn't angry either. It was something that I accepted.
What did he say to you at that first meeting?
Well, he looked at me quite a while and mentioned that I resembled, had cheekbones like his sister Gertrude. He had three sisters, a set of twins, and this older sister Gertrude. And he complimented my mother, told her that she had a very beautiful daughter. And she did make the statement, "Boy, she looks like you." But other than that, he went on talking about my plans for school and so forth.
What did your mother tell you about how she started having a relationship with Strom Thurmond?
Well, she told me that she worked in the kitchen. She was the cook. And her other sister did the house cleaning. And she said that they all knew each other very well. And he was in the kitchen quite a bit. And since that's where she was working, they got to know each other and they worked very closely together.
Now, she was 15 at the time they started having their relationship, and he was 23. What was it like for you when you were about 16 to learn that your mother was even younger than
Well, the age I was when I met him, that's the age she was when I was born. So I was still in school, and did not have the kinds of experience that she had, you know. So it was totally different for me because I was very much protected by my aunt. That's one of the things I could certainly appreciate, the way that she brought me up. She was very strict about my schooling, and she did not allow me to run the streets. Some of the young girls in those days could do what they wanted to do. I wasn't allowed to do that. I was highly protected, and I didn't like it at that time, but as I grew older, I appreciated what she had done. She did all she could do to see that I had a good life.
Now, when your mother introduced you to your father, Strom Thurmond, your mother still seemed to be in love with him. Did you have any sense of what his feelings were toward her?
Well, he seemed very warm towards her, and she seemed the same. In fact, she spoke so highly of him at all times, and she was saying how smart he was and how nice he was. She just thought he was a wonderful person.
Well, when you met your father, Strom Thurmond, you say you finally had an explanation for why you had the lightest skin in your family. Had that been a source of confusion for you up until that point?
I hadn't thought that much about it, actually, other than I do know all my people were a brown color, all of them. And I was the only one that looked different, but I didn't look that different from other children that I had grown up with in my neighborhood. There were people of all colors, so I didn't feel unusual in this comparison with the others, but it's within my own family that I look different.
Early on, after you met your father, during World War II, he was on a trip to Philadelphia, and he suggested that you meet him at a hotel room. You were expecting a fancy hotel, but it was a day room in what you describe as a semi-flea bag. Did you think this was because he was trying to meet you in secret, that he couldn't be seen with you in his real hotel room?
Well, I think perhaps, well, of course, I wouldn't have gone had it not been for my aunt. She accompanied to Philadelphia. I would not have gone there alone. But when he met with us, apparently it's not as though we had met for lunch or something. It was in a private room, and I guess that's because he didn't want to be seen with us. And even though he wasn't known in that area, but a person, I guess, in his position, you never know who might see you. Even after I got to know him better, whenever I met him, it was always in a public place. It was never just private, generally speaking.
So he needed you to keep this a secret. Did he ask you to keep it a
secret? He never said he needed this. Mm-hmm. He never said that he needed to keep it a secret. He never suggested that I had to keep it a secret. There was no talk about secrecy. The fact that things were the way they were in the relationship, it wasn't anything I wanted to talk about, but I was never told to not talk about it.
Why didn't you want to talk about it?
Well, first of all, during that time when he was a segregationist and he was speaking out against the black race, I didn't feel that was anything for me to be proud of because I was black. And so, therefore, I didn't want people to even know that he was my father. It wasn't until later years that as we grew closer together And he seemed to have changed many of his ways that I really began to feel proud of him.
So you both had this connection to each other, and there were reasons you each had to not want the world to know of the connection.
It was more or less understood. We didn't discuss it in that manner. Mm-hmm. But I respected him, and he respected me. And I was not told to keep any secrets.
My guest is Essie Mae Washington Williams. She's written a new memoir called Dear Senator. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Essie Mae Washington Williams, and she's written a memoir called Dear Senator, a memoir by the daughter of Strom Thurmond. And it wasn't until he died at the age of 100 that she revealed that he was her father. When he opposed President Truman's civil rights legislation, denouncing it as anti-American, he defended segregation laws as essential to the racial protection and purity of the white and Negro race alike. And he talked about Southerners never being willing to allow blacks in their homes. Do you remember the words that he said?
Oh, I read that speech many times. And it's strange because when he was elected governor in 1947, the people in South Carolina, the black people in particular, had high hopes that things would improve because he had already established a trade school for blacks, which they did not have. They had one for the whites, but not for the blacks. That was one of the positive things he had done and had other plans. But once this election came about in 1948, he seemed to have made a complete change. And was going in the opposite direction of what they had anticipated. So that was a disappointment.
So, you know, your father said, all the laws of Washington and all the bayonets of the army cannot force the Negro race into our theaters, our swimming pools, our schools, our churches, our homes. How did you feel hearing that?
I've heard that speech many times. And And I think in so speaking, he was addressing his constituents in particular because they're the ones who had put him into office, and he felt obligated to support them in whatever things that they wanted to accomplish. So to me, within his heart, I never really felt that he felt that way. And the type of person he seemed to have become in later years, say in the 70s, was the type of person I always saw him as. But this was the other side of him that the public did not know. There was a double image there, the way he was and the way he portrayed himself.
Did you feel that with those comments, your father was showing a side to you that you hadn't seen before? Were you surprised at the depth of his, pro-segregation feelings, of his anti-civil rights feelings?
Well, prior to those statements that he made in 1948, I had not heard such statements before. And I do know a little something about politics, and I realized that many things are said to get their point across, and it may not necessarily be what that person really feels at heart. And I had said also that I felt the type of person he was when I first met him and was in contact with him during the time he was governor, it was quite different from the change that he made when he ran for president. And I had also stated that I felt that he was speaking and saying the things that his constituents wanted to hear.
So you thought that he was a better man in private than he was in public?
As far as the type of person he was, I definitely felt that the people who knew him in South Carolina also knew that he was a different type of person from what he had spoken out and portrayed the image of himself.
What did you say to him about his anti-civil rights and pro-segregation comments?
Well, I told him that I didn't appreciate the remarks that he was making. Why was he saying those things? And why wouldn't he try to do something more positive to make things better, not worse? And he was saying that it had always been the custom in the South to have the races separated. He didn't create that. That's the way it always was. And there wasn't too much one person could do about it anyway.
When your father talked about never allowing black people into the homes or the swimming pools of white families, did you think he was a hypocrite? I mean, here he is saying that, you know, white people will never open up their homes to blacks, right? But it's okay for him to share a bed with a black woman. It's okay for him to impregnate a black woman. I mean, what does that say about where he really stood on the separation of the races?
Well, I think what he had done was what many others had done. It was more or less a custom, it seems. There are many situations that are similar to mine. And the reason people are hearing about my situation is because he became such a famous person. But it was very common.
Oh, absolutely, it's very common. And I mean, you could argue that it was a very common form of hypocrisy that a lot of white segregationists practiced.
Oh, yes. And that was generally throughout the South.
But I guess I'm wondering, did you see your father as being a hypocrite on that level because he had this relationship with your mother, because he impregnated her?
Well, that seems to be the general opinion. But I just still felt within his heart that he did care about my mother. I feel that she cared about him. It was one of those situations where the type of relationship they had could not come about. There wasn't anything they could do about that. And it was unfortunate.
You also say in your book that in his eyes, you think he never thought of you as fully a Negro. That's what you say.
I'm not sure how he felt it, because he never did express it. He just said that he looked at me as a person that he had interest in and was willing to help. But as far as race is concerned, he never went into the racial part of it.
You grew up in the North in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, and you knew you wanted to go to college. After you left home, you lived in Manhattan, and you saw a sophisticated world, a world where the races mixed, a world that had gay people in it, a world that had intellectuals and writers in it. And you had high hopes for the college you went to, and your father offered to help finance your college education, but he really wanted you to go to Orangeburg, a segregated college in his state of South Carolina.
He wanted me to go anywhere I wanted to go. At that time, I had gone to New York. I was in a nursing program with the Nurses Corps, which was set up in 1945 because of the great shortage of nurses. And since I had worked at Coatesville Hospital for about 3 years during the summers and on weekends, I became highly interested in nursing at that time. But because of segregation, I could not go to that hospital. Had things been different in those days, that's probably where I would have gone and probably never would have left Coatesville. However, I had to go to the big city. I didn't want to go to Philadelphia. I went to New York, to Harlem Hospital. And it was like a little city in itself. It's a huge hospital. I didn't really care for it there. And I told my mother when I went home, I thought I would leave the school because I was interested in going to college instead, which was my second choice, going to college. And I was interested in business education. And that's the decision I made. But at that time, I had not looked into any schools. Meanwhile, I had applied to South Carolina State when he mentioned his school to me, And I thought that would be a nice place to go. I had lots of relatives there. It was away from home. I would leave New York. But in the meantime, I took some classes at NYU, an educational psychology and history of education, to actually get started. And I had those credits transferred when I went to South Carolina State. And I enjoyed going to South Carolina State. I never regretted that decision. I met wonderful people there, including my husband. And I had a very good experience at South Carolina State College. And I love that school even today.
Essie Mae Washington Williams is the author of the new memoir, Dear Senator. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes, and from the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease. On the web at alz.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our conversation with Essie Mae Washington Williams, the once secret daughter of Strom Thurmond. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers what a best-selling grammar book and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy have in common, and Lord Schwartz reviews new recordings by Maria Callas. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Essie Mae Washington Williams. She's written a new memoir called Dear Senator. Shortly after Senator Strom Thurmond died at the age of 100, she revealed that she was a secret daughter. Her mother was African American and worked as a maid in his family's house in the mid-1920s when Washington Williams was conceived. It wasn't until Washington Williams was 16 that she learned who her father was. Although he never publicly acknowledged his paternity, he did help her financially, including paying for her college education.
When you got married, your husband, when you finally told him about the true identity of your father, your husband didn't like the idea of taking Strom Thurmond's money.
During the time that my husband was in school, he was going to school on the GI Bill of Rights. And I was not working except a little part-time job on the campus. So we needed as much money as we could get. And as far as my education was concerned, he did not mind my accepting money for that. However, when he finished school and our situation changed, he didn't want me to accept any money because he said he could take care of his own family. And we had little disagreements about that because sometimes I felt I really needed the money for other things. And when my husband and I were first married, he had heard about Strom Thurmond being my father, as everyone else on the campus had heard. But it wasn't anything we talked about. I never brought up the subject to him. He never mentioned to me, but he did know about it. And it wasn't until his cousin had said something one day about him marrying the governor's daughter, and he came home. He told me about him. That's the point at which we had this discussion. And he didn't have a real hatred for my father as such as this, that he did not like his politics. Well, no black person did. Who would like his politics when he was sitting up making all those negative remarks about blacks? Naturally, people didn't like that.
Well, your husband said, is this why I fought Hitler, so I could come home to a man like this?
Well, he was very sensitive about the fact that so many black soldiers had gone abroad to fight for this country, and they came back, and they still weren't treated equally. So that was a very sensitive matter with him, because he felt he had gone to war to fight and still be treated as a second-class citizen when he returned home.
So everyone on the campus in South Carolina had this idea that you really were Strom Thurmond's daughter? I mean, do you have any idea
how... Well, the rumor was around.
Yeah, how did it get started? How do people... You know, here you are. You're keeping it secret. He's keeping it secret. So how does the word get out, do you think?
Okay. During the time that my father was the governor, he would visit the various colleges, including South Carolina State. And when he came to South Carolina State, he knew the president there. And the president knew that he was the one who had recommended the school for me and so forth and was paying my tuition. Told him to send for me. He wanted to talk with me. And the young lady came over to the dormitory to tell me that the governor was there and he wanted to speak with me. And, of course, the word got all over the campus about the governor coming to the college and asking to speak to me. There were some students there, not too many, from Edgefield, who'd heard the rumor. In fact, most of the people in Edgefield had heard the rumor, and other places of South Carolina also. But it wasn't commonly known. It was a thing that was whispered. So after that, word was around the campus that he was my father and he had come to visit me. So that's how it got out.
How would you deny it?
No one approached me personally and asked me about it, but I knew the students had been talking because my roommate told me one day that the things that were being said, I never even admitted to her or to anybody. I told her he was just a friend of the family, that my relatives knew his family very well. And that's as much as I had said to anybody about that relationship.
Now, you kept the secret of your father from everybody. You told your husband after a while, and then when your children were grown, you decided to tell them. How did you break the news to them?
Well, I had been going back east periodically on a business trip, and the children knew that I would go that morning and I would be back home by evening. I did not explain it to them at that time. I just told them that I had some business I had to take care of. But when he came to Los Angeles to speak at one of the big churches there, he had called and asked me if I would bring the children to this church. He would like to see them. And so I did that. That was the time when I started to explain it to them, who he was. I let them know that he was a Caucasian, all that. I didn't keep it as my mother had kept it from me. And they were prepared. And after the speech was over, he was shaking hands with everyone, as they usually do. And we sort of waited around, and he came over and talked to us, each one of them.
Your children's reaction, what was it?
Oh, very positive. It was very positive. They were glad to meet him because they didn't have a grandfather. That was the only grandfather they knew, because my husband's father was deceased. And that was a happy experience for them.
Well, how did they react to him politically? I mean, all your children by this point had big afros. One of your sons was, had Black Panther posters on his walls. The other son was, idolized Martin Luther King. So how did they deal with their grandfather's politics and the reality of that?
Well, they didn't know too much about politics at that time. But as they did learn more and more about him, I explained the situation about the separations of the races in the South and so forth, and they were understanding.
My guest is Essie Mae Washington Williams. She's written a new memoir called Dear Senator. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Essie Mae Washington Williams. Shortly after the death of Senator Strom Thurmond, she publicly acknowledged that she was his secret daughter. Her mother was African American and worked as a maid in his family's house in the mid-1920s. You write in your book, "Heroes are entitled to their idiosyncrasies. My father's was an obsession with beautiful, very young women." Are you referring to the fact that Strom Thurmond was a hero to you or a hero to others, or...
Well, he was more of a hero to others, to his own, so much so that they elected him 8 times to Congress, 48 years of service, more than anyone else. And so he was a hero to them.
So now you're saying that he had an obsession with beautiful, very young women. Did that make you uncomfortable?
No, it did not make me feel uncomfortable because he'd... both of his wives were much younger. When he married his first wife, she was 21. He was in his 40s. And the last wife, Nancy, she was about 22, and he was 66 then. So he had always been involved with young women.
Well, looking back, do you think that his relationship with your mother when your mother was 15 fits into that, like, lifelong interest with younger women?
Of course, at that time,
he was in his 20s
himself. Yeah, he was very young himself. But at any rate, it was still, he was a grown man, and she was not yet grown up. She was just a teenager. But apparently she cared about him, and he cared about her. And it was just one of those situations that they couldn't do anything about.
I'm going to ask you a question that's kind of personal, and I don't mean... So if this is too personal or makes you uncomfortable, you just let me know, but I can't help but wonder about this. I think it's fair to say that your mother believed that, that she loved Strom Thurmond and that he cared for her, and that over the years you've believed that he cared for her. A lot of outsiders might think that he used her, because she was a servant, and that's what a lot of white men did in the South at that time, and that it wasn't a sign so much of deep affection as it was of convenience and power.
Well, it's always easy to say things. people always make statements, but they don't know what happened between those two people. They have no way of knowing that. And I don't know either. I just have the feeling from knowing both of them that there was a deep caring there.
Now, you didn't reveal your identity until after Strom Thurmond's death. Even though journalists had been knocking on your door, having heard the rumors, and you didn't talk to them about it, why did you want to reveal his paternity after his death?
I never actually wanted to reveal it at any time. I had started to write a book some years before he died about my life, more or less information for my children. And after he passed, my children already knew the story, and they were had actually encouraged me to write a book, complete that book that I had started. So I agreed to write the book, and so that's what happened. And I had no idea it would be as big as it is. Even when we went down to South Carolina to make the statement, I was amazed at the number of people who had turned out from all over the country, photographers and others, and the room was actually overflowing. And the people there were so warm and receptive. So it became a much larger thing than I ever anticipated.
And did you decide to wait until after his death to bring the story out?
I wasn't waiting for his death. The reason I had never done anything prior to that is because during the time, well, you know, he worked almost until his death. Mm-hmm. He had retired in December. And then that January, he had a big birthday party in December when he was 100 years old. That January, he retired, and then he died 6 months later. And it was 6 months later that I came out with the announcement. I would not have done anything prior to that because, as I've stated many times, it was no advantage to me to try to discredit him or hurt him in any way. I would not have wanted to do that. I cared enough about him not to want to hurt him. And then I didn't want it known. So for those two reasons alone, I never had any intentions of making any announcement. And the only thing that I said recently was, once he was out of politics and he was very ill, he only lasted 6 months more. It would have been nice if he had actually publicly acknowledged me after that time, because in that way it wouldn't have damaged him. However, I know he also had a family, and that's probably why he still never acknowledged me publicly.
What was the reaction of Strom Thurmond's family, his widow, his children, when they found out about you?
Well, they accepted me into the family. In fact, just last summer, my name was added to my father's statue. It was added along with all the other children. And we have a good relationship. I am in contact with them. And when I go to South Carolina within the next week or so, I'll probably get together and have lunch with them.
How did you let them know? Was it through a lawyer that they found out about you?
Well, it was in the news. I didn't even know them at that time. But it was in the news, and they heard it like everyone else.
Oh.
And my attorney was in contact with my brother. He had written to him. And they have had some correspondence.
Just one more question. Do you think that, say you'd gone public, or say he'd gone public, do you think it would have changed him politically? Do you think it would have made him less the segregationist and more more willing to think about the importance of civil rights?
Well, that's difficult to say. I really don't know. He might have survived that if it had been revealed. He was so well-liked, he might have survived, and he might not have. I really can't say. I don't know.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, surely it's been my pleasure.
Essie Mae Washington Williams is the author of the new memoir, Dear Senator. One of the most unexpected bestsellers of the past year was Lynn Truss's Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, a book about, of all things, punctuation. But according to our linguist Jeff Nunberg, the book's success may not be that surprising after all.
The author photo inside the cover of Lynn Truss's Eats, Shoots, and Leaves shows Truss with a marker poised to insert a missing apostrophe on a poster for the movie 2 Weeks' Notice. That's an allusion to her proposal to form vigilante groups who will venture out in ski masks in the dead of night, correcting the punctuation on signs and billboards. Like other pop grammarians, Truss is always addressing her audience as a tiny band of beleaguered partisans who stand between the language and out-and-out barbarism. As in, how long before the last few punctuation sticklers are obliged to take refuge together in caves? Actually, she'd better change that caves to caverns if she's planning to accommodate all the people who have bought her book. Almost a year after its American publication, it's still perched near the top of the bestseller lists, even as more recent books by Bill Clinton and David Sedaris have receded from the ranks. In fact, for all their talk of beleaguered minorities, writers like Truss, John Simon, and Edwin Newman have turned sticklerism into a popular entertainment that appeals to a far wider audience than an old-fashioned high-culture grammarian like H.W. Fowler could ever have dreamed of. True, most of Truss's readers aren't dyed-in-the-wool grammar buffs, the sorts of people who correct the spelling on restaurant menus and begin their sentences by saying, "I pride myself." They simply enjoy a lively rant, particularly if it flatters their taste in the bargain. And a lively rant is what Truss gives them, garrulous, rambling, and brimming with melodramatic outrage. To hear her tell it, not a day goes by that a faulty punctuation mark doesn't leave her appalled, gasping, shuddering, gazing in horror, or stopping dead in her tracks with her fingers in her mouth. That's all deliberately over the top, of course. Anybody who was actually walking around in a state of outrage over the punctuation of email messages and movie posters would have serious priority issues. We're meant to take it as campy exaggeration. If you play your pedantry broadly enough, nobody can accuse you of taking yourself too seriously. In fact, Truss's book bears a resemblance to another surprise cultural phenomenon, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Those fantasies about forming a militia of Kamahadin bring to mind the Queer Eye SWAT team swooping in after dark to replace somebody's tacky shower curtain. And those operatic denunciations of punctuation errors are exactly what you'd expect from the Queer Eye bunch if they added a grammar makeover specialist. Oh, my God. Did you hear that pronoun? But in a postmodern world, mocking your foibles is also a way of giving yourself license to indulge them. It's like karaoke singers who clown and mug as they sing songs by the Carpenters that they're embarrassed to admit they actually cherish. And for pop grammarians like Truss, you can't help feeling that the self-mockery is a cover for self-congratulation. She may make fun of herself as a stickler, but she clearly considers herself to be one of a select few. Somebody whose sleep is troubled by a misplaced apostrophe, even if it's 20 mattresses down. That's where the resemblance to Queer Eye ends. As Susan Sontag pointed out 40 years ago in a famous essay, true camp is always infused with generosity, even when it affects a malicious tone. It's about relishing, not judging. That's why the last scene of every Queer Eye episode shows the team chatting fondly about the schlubby straight guy they've turned into a swan. But despite her relentless jollity, generosity isn't Truss's long suit. It doesn't take much to launch her into an aria of indignation, a superfluous apostrophe in a pizza ad, the name of a pop group, or a sign over the vegetable bin. H.W. Fowler would have cut people a bit more slack there. After all, the English language isn't going to stand or fall on the strength of its supermarket signage. It's true that for most readers, Truss's orthographic snobbery is merely amusing. After all, a knowledge of the apostrophe is a pretty trifling hook to hang your self-esteem on. But the book has come in for rough treatment by reviewers like Louis Menand in The New Yorker and Edmund Morris in The New York Times, writers that you wouldn't ordinarily expect to bother with a book like this at all. That may be because they see Truss's book as trivializing a subject that they take very seriously. When we turn punctuation into an occasion for feeling superior to the local tradesman, we're letting ourselves off too easily. Anybody can master the simple rituals of the apostrophe, but it's a more humbling exercise to confront the austere disciplines of the colon, dash, and semicolon. And for all her self-assurance, Truss doesn't show much sign of having grappled with those mysteries. In fact, her own punctuation is alarmingly insouciant at times. She tosses semicolons into her sentences in something like the way I scatter fennel seed when I'm cooking, in the vague hope it'll somehow pull the other ingredients together. The difference is that no publisher would let me get anywhere near a cookbook.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and the author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD and a new DVD featuring Maria Callas. This is Fresh Air. One of the most popular soprano arias in all of Italian opera is Puccini's O Mio Bambino Caro. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that the pretty tune gives sopranos a chance to show off their voices. But according to Lloyd, few sopranos ever sing this aria with a real understanding of what it means. You can hear the exception on a new DVD.
Have you ever seen a performance of Romeo and Juliet in which Juliet delivers her most famous line as, "O Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?" Juliet, of course, hasn't known Romeo long enough yet to be concerned with his whereabouts. Wherefore doesn't mean where at all, but why. She's asking why he's Romeo. Why did she have to fall in love with a Montague, her family's archenemy? The line should read, "O Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?" I hear a similar misunderstanding in most performances of a famous soprano aria, Puccini's O Mio Bambino Caro, from his short opera Gianni Schicchi. In the aria, the heroine, Loretta, is threatening to throw herself off the Ponte Vecchio, the famous bridge in Florence, and most sopranos emphasize this potential tragedy. But the opera it's from is actually a comedy. Loretta isn't really going to attempt suicide. She's begging her Bambino Caro, her dear daddy, for permission to buy a wedding ring so she can marry the young man she loves. "If you don't let me buy it," she wheedles, "I'll throw myself into the Arno. So come on, have pity, have a heart." Sopranos love this aria. It's pretty, it's short, and it's not very high. But one of the very few who really understood Puccini's tone was Maria Callas. On her famous early album of Puccini arias, she captures the aria's playfulness. But in a 1965 concert on French television, Callas, in terrific voice, suggests even further how Loretta's mercurial emotions flicker from romantic love to tender affection for her father to that comic, wheedling threat. Callas offers a kind of roadmap of the aria, showing all the different directions the emotions take. It's thrilling to hear it done right, and it makes almost every other performance, no matter how beautifully sung, seem misguided. Here's the complete aria. Thank you. Callis's face is so expressive. The performance is even better when you see it. EMI has issued it on DVD along with two other arias Callis did on that French TV show. That concert is so important, EMI released it in two different formats. On one DVD, the three arias are coupled with Callis's fascinating television interviews about her career, her range of roles. She talks about how singing is really about life. The other version is both the DVD and a CD with seven of Callis's greatest Verdi recordings. Films of Callis' performances are extremely rare, and they're all amazing. But this one stands out even in that rarefied context.
Lloyd Schwartz writes for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the Callis Conversations on DVD and Maria Callis Legend, a CD that includes a DVD of Callis performing on French TV. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with James Brown. I'm Terry Gross. Join us.